It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Kellyanne Conway has a new book out. You may have heard something about that. And I've taped a wide-ranging, really interesting interview with her that will air Sunday morning on Fox's Media Buzz. You notice the way I just kind of took that promo and embedded it very subtly into the news of the day. But here is the news of the day. The most striking thing to me in the book, and it's about her life, and I've talked about it on the podcast before, her tenure in the White House, tumultuous 4 years, her family, her kids, her marriage, is that she says flatly that after the 2020 election, she went to the president and said, "You have lost this election." That while people around him were saying, "No, it can be overturned. You didn't really lose. There was widespread fraud." She says she's the first person who Donald Trump trusted who told him that he had lost. Well, they have had a good relationship even after he went down to Mar-a-Lago. But inevitably came the Trumpian statement. And here's part of it. "Kellyanne Conway never told me that she thought we lost the election. If she had, I wouldn't have dealt with her any longer. She would have been wrong. Could go back to her crazy husband." So look at the way he does that, you know, denies the conversation that she reports. Look, she was there. That's her version. Says, "Of course, I didn't lose the election," all in a couple of sentences, and takes a shot at the guy who once called the husband from hell, George Conway. And there are still difficulties in the Conway marriage, and I only say that because Kellyanne deals with that in the book and in some of the interviews that she's done, including with me. So I hope you have a chance to catch that. Here's your daily Elon. Elon Musk saying, "Use of the word billionaire as a pejorative is morally wrong and dumb." Well, of course you would say that if you had many, many, many billions of dollars. He's been, I think he just gets bored. He's been engaging with lots of people on Twitter on all kinds of subjects, including Tesla. I mentioned a few days ago, Bill de Blasio, former mayor of New York City, who ran for president, got completely and totally clobbered, then tried to run for governor of New York State after his term expired, couldn't get any support at all and dropped out, and now is running for a seat in Congress in a district that includes part of the Brooklyn neighborhood where he grew up. So you would think, okay, there he might have a shot. Well, new poll from WPIX television in New York and the Hill, gives de Blasio 6% of the vote. Now, it's not as horrible as it might sound because there's two other contenders who have like 8% and 7%. But and everybody else is undecided. But if you're a former two-term mayor of New York City and you can only muster 6%, I mean, everybody knows you. It's not like, you know, three people that no one's ever heard of. That is pathetic. Also sad, and I guess you could say pathetic, Kevin Spacey has been charged with 4 counts of sexual assault in the UK. I once met Kevin Spacey for about 5 seconds at one of the White House correspondents' dinners. And I think he's a tremendous actor. I loved him in House of Cards, at least until this kind of thing all blew up and he got written out of the sixth and final season. The reason these charges are being brought in London, and BuzzFeed reports that the alleged incidents occurred in 2005, 2008, and 2013, is that he was directing a play at the Old Vic Theatre in that city. One of Spacey's accusers, I mean, this isn't totally new, a guy named Harry Dreyfuss, had written a column for BuzzFeed claiming that Spacey groped him in 2008, while his father, Richard Dreyfuss, was starring in the play. The Old Vic Theater revealing that it received 20 personal testimonies from people claiming that Spacey engaged in alleged inappropriate behavior. So now that will move to some kind of legal proceeding. All right, let's turn our attention to Texas, story number one. You know, what's coming out now about the horrible, heartrending massacre in the elementary school there in Uvalde, Texas, is that the versions given to the media by police have not just been wrong or misleading or, you know, fog of war confusion. They've been lies. I mean, Governor Greg Abbott, I'm not blaming him, you know, holds a news conference, the law enforcement reacted appropriately and so forth. And now they still don't have answers about what happened. And more and more that's coming out looks like this was horribly mishandled. Now, let me take a second to say, you know, we expect a lot of our police. And we expect them to insert themselves into dangerous situations. Nobody wants to see them go on a suicide mission. It is, in many ways, a thankless job. But when you are a member of a police department and children are being threatened and you've got a mass of people heavily armed, you are expected to do that job. And it's added to the grief, I think, in the community and in the country surrounding this, because what we were told initially was, well, there were two, you know, for people who were saying stricter school security is the answer, and I may well be in that camp, there were two armed officers stationed at this school. And originally it's like, well, they engaged with the gunman, but he got inside anyway. Well, it turns out that's complete and total bull. They didn't engage in the gunman. The local police officials now acknowledge that neither of the officers, confronted the gunman before he just walked in through an unlocked door. He walked in unobstructed initially, says the regional director of the State Department of Public Safety. He was not confronted by anybody. So that's just made up. It was fiction, fake news. Then you had the parents, and you probably have seen some of these videos, who were outside the school as the gunfire erupted inside, and it turns out initially this was disputed, but another lie, which is there was a period of more than an hour before police, and obviously backup had been called, and these are heavily armed officers, went in to the school, with one exception. There were two officers that went in and got shot at, and I guess that made the other officers think, well, maybe this is not the best way to handle it. But meanwhile, the parents are understandably going absolutely crazy. And some of those parents were off-duty law enforcement members who went inside to try to find their own kids. Understandable. So the guy gets in through an unlocked door, and there was a mother of two students at this Robb Elementary School. And according to the Wall Street Journal and other accounts, her name is Mrs. Gomez. She was put in handcuffs by federal marshals for intervening in an active crime scene because she and other parents were demanding. They were saying, go in. What are you waiting for? Why are you standing around? Now, even after being put in handcuffs, she was able to move away from the crowd scene, went in to the school and was able to rescue her kids. Remember, all of the horrible fatalities took place in a single classroom. Another parent, according to Gomez, was pepper sprayed as he attempted to get into the school. Now, on the one hand, I understand, you know, they can't just let parents take the law into their own hands. On the other hand, why were parents wanting to do this? They were wanting to do this because the police were seeming, in their eyes, to do nothing to go in and save these kids. And had they gone in earlier, massive show of force, undoubtedly there would have been some fatalities, but many lives could have been saved of the 21 people, 19 students, two teachers, who were killed there. And it just adds to the sense of frustration. Now, for the political take, let's go to Politico, which has a piece today saying in roughly 48 hours, since yet another mass shooting, and that's certainly fair phraseology, President Biden has tried deliberately to stay above the legislative and political scrum. He hasn't chastised Republicans for standing in the way of passing gun control legislation that he favors. He's allowed Senate Democrats to set the tone of the public debate while he tries to offer comfort to the families of victims and explores his options. And that has caused some backlash. Here's a quote from a guy who runs the gun safety group Giffords, undoubtedly founded by or named after Gabby Giffords, who was wounded in Arizona in another mass shooting many years ago. He can't just be the eulogizer in chief. He needs to put the full force of his office into the legislative process. Otherwise, it will seem like he's lost hope. White House aides and some allies, according to Politico, say the current posture won't likely change soon. He thinks that White House sources say that it could backfire if Biden were to go in and start criticizing Republican lawmakers, or they'll trying to have some kind of negotiation, which I'll get to in a second. But others think this is just foot dragging and they're perplexed by the White House stance. Look, I mean, Biden came out and gave a very emotional speech after this happened. And look, he knows, I know, you know, the chances of any even incremental legislation passing are pretty slim. So in pure political terms, he doesn't want to have this on his hands. And he's been through this before. After the Sandy Hook tragedy in 2012, Barack Obama tried to push gun control legislation. He made Vice President Biden the point man, and they tried and tried. And, you know, the shock and outrage was as big, if not bigger, than we have now, where I'm just reading that 2020 being the most recent year, guns are now the most frequent cause of death for children, overtaking car accidents. I mean, it just makes you want to tear your hair out. But as far as what's happening on the Hill, you know, Biden, everything is about timing. You know, when it's useful for him to step in, he would step in just to give a bunch of speeches now. Then he's accused of politicizing it. I mean, there's no perfect answer. Meanwhile, there's a small group of Republican and Democratic senators who've begun talks on some kind of compromise legislation. And, you know, whenever there's a group, this is true on immigration reform, when there's a gang of six, a gang of eight, whatever, usually nothing ends up happening because they can all agree and then they can't sell it to their respective caucuses. So a leading Democrat on this, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, says we're at the point in this debate where we need something. We need to show progress. People are frightened. I'm probably much more willing to accept something smaller and important, but incremental, than I was a few months after Sandy Hook. Chuck Schumer says we have no illusions that this will be easy. We've been burned in the past when Republicans promised to debate only to break their promise, you know, but this is such a raw issue, says Schumer, that we have to try. Now, one slight bit of optimism is that Mitch McConnell has named one of his top allies, Texas Senator, naturally John Cornyn, to work with Chris Murphy across the aisle, trying to come up with a deal. I'm hopeful we can come up with a bipartisan solution, says McConnell. But is that a genuine effort to do something? Or is it just stalling for time and then, you know, the issue fades and the media and the public move on? Michelle Goldberg, liberal columnist, has a very emotional piece today about gun control. And she's all about, you know, blaming the Republicans and Republicans don't care and so forth. But the reason she says, take into account where she's coming from, the horrifying irony, the hideous ratchet, is the more America is besieged by senseless violence, the more the paramilitary wing of the American right is strengthened. But what I wanted to get to was these paragraphs, because I think, even though she frames it as being the view of liberals, I think it's actually how most Americans feel. You know, sometimes I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm alone in this, or not that many people think this. I think the country it's just been touched by this in a way that many of these other mass shootings. I mean, of course, fourth graders, you know, our inability to protect children. I just think there is a national anguish, a sense of depression. Why can't we change this? Why can't we make progress? Why can't we save lives? A kind of a pained resignation, I would say. And so Goldberg writes, among liberals, and I would say, and yes, other Americans as well, there's an overwhelming feeling of despair, she writes. Even as people learn the names of all those murdered children, the most common sentiment is not never again, but a bitter acknowledgement that nothing is going to change. America is too sick, too broken. It is perhaps beyond repair. I hope in my heart of hearts that that's not the case, that America is not too sick or too broken to make some progress on this horrible issue with the rest of the world. As I wrote in a column the other day, thinks we're crazy. It's a very fraught issue. It's almost a cultural issue. It's, you know, Republicans don't want to give any ground because their tribe believes that any infringement on, you know, of course, obviously there are laws about background checks. Maybe they should go further. There are laws about how old you have to be, 18 years old to buy a gun. The last two shooters, Buffalo and Uvalde, 18 years old. Maybe it should be 21. I mean, we could go on and on through the various proposals, but it's not like it's completely unregulated. At the same time, I think that there is a sense of despair because the political system is broken. It's broken on a whole lot of things. And look, it's been a tough couple of years. COVID and baby formula shortage and Ukraine and all of this. But I'm not going to throw myself into the despairing camp. You know, if political leaders would lead, perhaps some progress could be made.
Hey, let's pause right there. The Buzz Meter continues right after this.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Now, speaking of Ukraine, story number two. An interesting debate here about how is this going to end? We're into the third month of the war. And there's a pretty smart New York Times piece saying that there's been an Italian proposal for a ceasefire. Ukraine wants to push Russia back to the pre-invasion borders. And the war can't go on forever, so how do you settle it? Fundamental debate about whether or not the effort to integrate Russia into the world community should just end. So the U.S. wants to refer to Russia as a pariah state that should be cut off from the world economy. Now, if Russia has failed, let's just say it right there, wanted to take over the country, to do it quickly and easily, wanted to capture Kyiv, and wasn't able to do any of these things. So now it's trying to bite off parts of the country along the eastern border with Russia and in the south. And so the administration, the Biden administration, is looking at a chance to punish Russian aggression, weaken Putin, shore up NATO, send a message to China, and above all, and this is the key thing, prove that aggression is not rewarded with territorial gains. None other than Henry Kissinger is out there saying, well, there must be some kind of negotiated settlement. Ideally, the dividing line should be returned to the status quo. And Zelensky, Volodymyr Zelensky, pushed back on this in the strongest possible terms, saying, I get the sense that instead of the year 2022, Kissinger has 1938 on his calendar. And then that was the year when Hitler began his military march across Europe. And Kissinger himself, as a teenager, fleeing with his family to New York. Nobody heard from him then, says Zelensky, that it was necessary to adapt to the Nazis instead of fleeing them or fighting them. But the piece goes on to say Zelensky himself has issued sort of contradictory thoughts on ending the war, even offering to commit his country to neutrality rather than joining NATO. That seems like a potentially promising path. Now, if Zelensky makes some concessions, would the U.S. and allies go along and lift some of the crushing sanctions on Moscow? Or would that in itself be a kind of a reward for Russian aggression? Now, look, there's no question that in the end, it is up to the Ukrainians. It's up to Zelensky and his people, the ones who have sacrificed the most, the ones who have suffered under this unjust invasion, the ones that have had these horrendous thousands and thousands of civilians killed by the brutal regime in the Kremlin. But for Joe Biden, if it is thought that the Ukraine has to cede more territory, as they ultimately did, not having a choice, with the Russian invasion of Crimea some 8 years ago, that will seem as rewarding Putin for just horrendous war criminal type behavior. Number three, I want to come back. I know, you know, this was like last week's crisis or the week before. And now we have the new crisis of mass shootings and we have Ukraine and we have COVID and so forth. But the baby formula shortage is, in my view, a completely self-inflicted crisis. And there was a whistleblower, and it turns out there's always a whistleblower somewhere whose concerns aren't taken into an account. So according to this Washington Post account, the whistleblower in the FDA sent a 34-page report back in October alleging that there were unsanitary conditions at the Abbott infant formula factory. Remember that this is the biggest supplier of baby formula under a sort of a near monopoly shared with three other U.S. companies. But when the whistleblower wrote this report, the top official in charge of food safety at the Food and Drug Administration did not see it. In fact, this guy, he's a Deputy Commissioner Frank Yiannis, didn't learn about the complaint until 4 months later. And Yiannis acknowledges this. And during that time, another infant death was linked to Abbott-produced formula. The plan was shut down. And that is what started the wheels turning toward this crisis that hasn't gone away. I mean, yes, the Biden administration is bringing in imports from other countries, but that should have been allowed all along. It's the failure to allow imports even from Canada that turned this into a heart-rending crisis for millions and millions of parents whose kids need the formula to survive. Yiannis says that that report wasn't sent to me, wasn't shared with me internally. How does this happen? There were early signals, and in any safety profession, you want to take those seriously to stop the domino effect. That didn't happen. So on the one hand, he's admitting the bureaucratic F-up. On the other hand, he's saying, don't blame me. The food policy divisions don't report to him. They report to the commissioner. But there was no commissioner until Robert Califf was appointed on February 17th. I think FDA had no permanent commissioner for a year. Another problem that's self-inflicted. Okay, Yiannis, more from Yiannis. Why didn't we act more quickly on the complaints and the whistleblower report? Who knew what when? Those are going to be some of the tough questions that will have to be answered. Now, this may undermine my faith in this guy a little bit. So it says, Yiannis spoke to the Post after calling back a reporter who stated their name, title, and nature of the story in a voicemail. After repeatedly addressing the reporter by name, Yiannis later terminated the conversation and claimed he did not realize he was speaking to a journalist. Okay, that sounds like somebody who doesn't know how the world works. If I call up and I say, this is Howard Kurtz, Fox News, I want to talk to you about a story. Guy calls him back, well, Howard, here's what I have to say. And I says, wait a minute, you're a journalist? You mean you're writing this down? Doesn't exactly inspire confidence. And this is a classic example of government taking a bad situation and making it much, much worse. Very quickly, number four. Who's the Treasury Secretary of the United States? You probably had to stop and think for a minute. Well, it's Janet Yellen. Janet Yellen, who had been at the Fed and has a sterling reputation as an economic policymaker. You barely hear anything about Janet Yellen anymore. And Politico has a whole takeout saying that, you know, she was kind of a celebrity in the world of economists. First woman to lead the Federal Reserve, for example. Now that Democrats are grappling with the high inflation, complete plunge in the stock market, rising fears of recession, Yellen is rarely on center stage. She wields less influence in the West Wing, says Politico, than her recent predecessors in the job did. You know, usually the Treasury Department's secretary, and she's the first woman, is out there, you know, doing television interviews and reassuring Wall Street and basically being the face of economic policy. Not so much with Janet Yellen. It says that in areas like tax policy, financial appointments, debt ceiling, China, Yellen and her Treasury Department have often taken a back seat to the White House National Economic Council or been overruled by the White House, according to nearly two dozen people, including current and former administration officials. She was rebuffed when she wanted to put her own person in as the top banking regulator. When the Dems were deliberating how to pay for the Build Back Better, which is now buried plan, White House officials led the discussions with Congress, not Yellen or another senior Treasury official. She's kind of seen as a technocrat, but, you know, never been an aspiring speaker. But it does tell you something that the Treasury Secretary, and I'm not saying she doesn't do her job, but, you know, in any cabinet agency, and this is true in the annals of the modern presidency, if the president doesn't allow, and a lot of criticisms have also been leveled at HH Secretary Javier Becerra not being the front and center guy during COVID. You know, who is? Anthony Fauci and other officials and Rochelle Walensky. So, you know, the White House has ultimate power. And if the White House doesn't want to let you out there, you kind of take a back seat. It's more than just television interviews. It's, you know, these internecine battles within the bureaucracy. If you're Treasury Secretary, your name is Pete Buttigieg, and you're very good on TV, and the White House wants you out there, you get out there on the Sunday shows, et cetera. But I guess I'd have to say that Yellen's been kind of a disappointment. I knew that that was true publicly, but according to Politico, internally as well.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
And finally, story number five. This is one of the newsletters from The Atlantic. Individual writers write these things, and they're often very good. This is a newsletter by Molly Jong Fast, and the headline is, Bill Maher isn't a liberal anymore. Well, is that true, or is he just not liberal enough for Molly Jong Fast? Who's a good writer, and you can tell from her name that she's the daughter of the famed novelist Erica Jong. She starts out by talking about something very specific, having to do with some comments that Bill Maher made on his HBO show, in which were actually praised by Marjorie Taylor Greene. It gets complicated. Now, Maher, according to this piece, may identify as a liberal, but he prides himself on just asking questions, a lot of which, she says, sound suspiciously like GOP talking points. So on Real Time with Bill Maher last week, he was questioning whether LGBTQ kids are really, you know, LGBTQ. And Maher said, yes, part of the rise in LGBT numbers is from people feeling free enough to tell it to a pollster, and that's all to the good. But some of it is, it's trendy. And Jong Fast goes on to say, well, LGBTQ kids are under attack. They're being bullied, harassed, and murdered. By dismissing how they identify as a trendy pose, Maher is kind of questioning their very existence. I don't know about that. I mean, the thing about Bill Maher is, he is an absolute liberal on most major issues, but he stands up to the Democratic Party when it goes bonkers, when it goes too far left. He delivers tough love. I mean, he once contributed $1 million of his own money to one of the Democratic Party organizations. And I think, look, that's what makes him interesting. Sometimes he says things that get repeated on Fox News because they like the idea. I mean, he always does it in entertaining and funny fashion. I was on his old show once, Politically Incorrect, and I've interviewed him, and he's a smart guy. And, you know, it's kind of like Jon Stewart. Yeah, he's a comedian, so he makes it funny, but look, he doesn't run away from the fact that he wants to have a cultural impact. So, what's interesting to me is, Molly Jong Fast says, I've been reluctant to write about Bill Maher because he was a great champion of my mother, the novelist I mentioned, and briefly in the 1990s, me. And I've been in that situation where I've had to write critically about people who I used to have a perfectly cordial relationship with, or were colleagues, or were friends. And it's tough. If you're going to do media criticism, sometimes you just got to bite the bullet. But in this attention economy, she writes, platforms like Maher's have enormous power. I wonder if he realizes how much power he really has. Using even a few minutes of his airtime to target a marginalized group is unforgivable. And then we get to the larger question, because, you know, Maher does get blowback from the left because he's willing to take on the left about language and excessive wokeness and all kinds of things. He's like a common sense liberal, you know, who thinks the Dems and the liberal movement have kind of lost their way. So from a recent interview, she quoted, Maher says this, let's get this straight. It's not me who's changed, it's the left, which is now made up of a small contingent who've gone mental and a large contingent who refuse to call them out for it. But I will. Now, her closing line is maybe a 66-year-old millionaire who's been on TV since 1993 isn't the progressive he thinks he is. Maybe it's not the left that has changed. Maybe, just maybe, it's Bill. And this is a classic debate in our scramble hyperpolarized politics that comes up a lot. You see this on the Republican side as well. You see all these people who were lifelong classic conservative Republicans, TV writers and thinkers, think tank people and columnists and commentators. And they couldn't stand Donald Trump. They liked some of his policies, but they thought his presidency was a train wreck. And so more and more and more, they went to places like CNN and MSNBC, which liked to be able to say, oh, here's a Republican, here's a conservative. Look at Joe Scarborough, conservative Republican congressman, who's become one of Donald Trump's, long ago became one of Donald Trump's fiercest detractors. So there was this split. And what these people said is, I haven't changed. I'm the same kind of traditional small government conservative Republican as I've always been, but look at where the party has moved. Capitol riot, January 6th, Trumpism and all that. And on the left, you have Joe Biden. The reason he won was that he was portrayed himself as a moderate liberal, common sense guy, who would bring back some normalcy. But then he gets elected, in part because he's not Donald Trump, and starts pushing this sweeping, very expensive, multi-trillion dollar, partially culture war agenda that Bernie Sanders in the White House would have perfectly comfortable pushing. So Bill Maher comes out and says these things. He says, I haven't changed. The left has changed. And it's almost like a battle for who owns the brand. Well, political parties evolve and change. The Democratic Party of right now is not even the Democratic Party of Barack Obama. The Republican Party right now is not even the Republican Party of George W. Bush. Both of them would have been seen as too mushy and too squishy to be the leaders of what are now more extreme, more ideological parties. And I should talk more about this subject because I think it is at the heart of where we are going or not going as a country. Well, hope you have a great weekend coming up on this Memorial Day weekend. I will be off for that Monday holiday, but back here on Tuesday. Once again, Media Buzz, Sunday morning, Kellyanne Conway, and lots of other stuff about the shooting and all the stuff that you get the sneak peek by virtue of listening to this podcast. Would love if you'd subscribe. We'll see you on Tuesday after the holiday weekend with more Buzzmeter.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.